Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, April 3rd, 2023. I'm your host, Magnus Thiebald. I'm happy to be here and I'm glad you're here with me as well. We have a good show for you today. We're going to start off with what's up in Burnaby, some of the big stories from Burnaby this week, our regular segment. After that, we're going to be talking to SFU 350. I don't know why the 350 comes out wrong so often when I try and say it. When we get to the interview a little later on, you hear me stumble over that a couple times at the beginning as well. It's weird. Anyway, we're going to be talking to SFU 350. They are an SFU student group working on issues related to climate change, and they've been doing a campaign to divestment campaign here on the campus, particularly looking at making some changes with the student society, but also the university. So we're going to be talking to Jaden Dyer and Natasha Evo from that, from SFU 350. And then a little later in the show, we'll be our regular Looking at Lyme segment this week. We'll be looking at Lyme. We'll be talking to Dr. Neil Nathan. All that and more coming up on Speak Up. Let's talk about what's up in Burnaby this week. We have big SFU story to get us started this week. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, as always.
And with me here is Srishti Gangdev, reporter with the Burnaby Beacon, and we're going to be talking about what's up in Burnaby this week. So a big SFU story to get us started this week. SFCU's Teaching Support Staff Union has voted 94% to give their leadership a strike mandate in negotiations with SFU.
That's right. So definitely a big story for your audience here, Magnus. I think this is something that, you know, students and graduate students and faculty alike have a lot of interest in. So the Teaching Support Staff Union, which represents about 3,800 members of the SFU community, has voted overwhelmingly in favor of strike action. And the main issue at hand here in negotiations with the university is wages, as it often is in these labor disputes. But the union is asking for a full, what it's calling a full cost of living adjustment from the university. And it's not clear right now what the job action could actually look like once they get started. I've been told it could be as small and unobtrusive as putting stickers at the top of, you know, graded assignments to like a full-on picket line. So we'll have to see what exactly happens there.
Yeah, I mean, the Teaching Support Staff Union basically is everyone in it pretty in a teaching role who isn't actually a professor. And if you've gone to university, you know that's a lot. A lot of different people and a substantial chunk of what it takes to deliver the courses that everyone's relying on. I know that the Teaching Support Staff Union, we talk to them quite regularly here at the radio station because it's always, I think there's long been a somewhat contentious relationship between the TSSU and SFU, particularly around, as you're mentioning, these wage issues. But just, you know, there's a lot of, I think, money pressures on the university, which get passed straight through to these staff. What is the university saying around this? What's their response to what's happening now?
Yeah, they're responding with what they say is disappointment. They say that, you know, the union, I should say, first has said that SFU hasn't responded to many of their demands in negotiations and hasn't made a concerted effort to really be present at those meetings as much as they want. They've also pointed out that instead of sending like a direct university representative, the university has outsourced, they're calling it, that those responsibilities to like a contractor or consultant. The university says, you know, that it feels that the union is the one walking away from the table with this notice that strike action could be coming. It says that it has tried to make itself available in the next few weeks. And then there's a little bit of back and forth happening here because the union says, well, that's not true. We gave you these dates and you didn't respond to that. And you know, the kind of typical back and forth, like I said, that you see in these kinds of disputes. At the end of the day, I think both sides, it's in the interest of both sides to get this resolved quickly, because as you said, that's a, you know, these union members make up a huge, huge chunk of everyday operations at the school. You know, they're your research assistants, they're teaching assistants, they're grad students, they're people who get a lot of stuff done on a day-to-day basis. And if this ends up leading like to a full picket line or to like a complete stoppage of work, it's going to have a big impact on research and on undergrad students and everyone at the university.
Now, we're still, despite the strike vote, we are still sort of in a negotiating phase around this issue. And I would, you know, if students are listening, you know, I would probably say it's not likely going to affect this semester or exams. I know the TSSU is very sensitive to, I mean, a lot of them are students themselves at the grad level. You know, they are sensitive to the impacts this can have on students. So that's one thing to be considered. But as I say, you know, the TSSU and SFU don't have the warmest relationship, because I think there are a lot of issues out there. And, you know, it's hard to say where this all leads. As you've mentioned, you know, there will be some sort of progressive action, and hopefully it doesn't lead to something highly disruptive. One thing I do, you know, I talked to someone from the TSSU back in the fall when they were getting ready for some of this negotiation, and some of their issues are pretty significant. You know, so, you know, we were speaking particularly about research assistants and some of the teaching assistants, grad students, and how some of the funding that they get hasn't really been revised in years. And as we know, you know, inflation and particularly the cost of living as related to housing is gone up a lot. So, mm-hmm. You know, I can see why the issue would be contentious.
This is a very active union. You know, I've been working at the Beacon for 2 years and covering Burnaby quite closely for 2 years. And I've had a lot of conversations with the TSSU. And, you know, I just want to touch on as well a rally that was held on, I believe it was last Thursday, with the unions on campus kind of have a coalition going with the contract workers that are on campus. So those are your janitors and your library workers, I believe, are included in that, but maybe I'm misremembering there. They're involved in their own disputes and negotiations, as are, you know, the wider coalition of grad students, and all of these organizations and associations are working together to kind of present a united front to the university, I would say. And the last thing that I wanted to mention is that the university has applied to the Labor Relations Board for mediation of this this dispute with the TSSU. So, you know, it's possible that strike action won't happen. I know finals are coming up for students. So definitely something to note is that nothing's really going on at the moment.
Yeah, but definitely a story we'll keep following. In another story, a Vancouver developer is looking for ways to relocate rather than demolish homes on land set for redevelopment. I know this happens occasionally, but is this sort of trying to create this into a more organized effort?
Mm-hmm. This is something that I thought was super interesting. So, you know, it is a private company. It's a private venture. where, you know, these development companies will occasionally, instead of demolishing a single family home, which, as we know, is pretty common in Burnaby, to, you know, there's a lot of older houses, maybe they'll build a new home on that same spot or whatever is happening. This company basically picks the house up and carts it off somewhere else to, you know, First Nations communities, or they talk a lot about like coastal communities in BC. And they are basically asking for the city's help in making it more logical for developers to take this step. They say that the biggest problem that they have with convincing developers that this is the right move for them is not the finances, because they would actually save quite a bit of money at face value to do this. But the biggest hurdle for them is time. They're concerned that if they take this route, then, you know, maybe their construction will be delayed and interest costs will outweigh the benefits of saving on the demolition. So the city, this company, Renewal Home Development, wants the city to step in and give incentives to these developers to take this route instead of going for demolition.
Yeah. And in, you know, aside from, you know, the sort of obvious benefits of saving the house, there's some statistics in your article that it, you know, between the energy costs of demolition, and the amount of waste generated is quite astonishing. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, so demolition and basically the waste from construction, I'm trying to remember the number that I had here, but it makes up a huge chunk of waste in our local landfills.
It really caught my attention, so I pulled it out here. About 100 tons of material waste from a house when it's destroyed, and that kind of waste makes up to half the waste in our local landfill. So it's like, wow. You
know, yeah, that's a huge amount. And I think what they're trying to do is prevent some of that. I think what they're looking at is those homes that have really good bones, as realtors would say, I guess. Yeah. And they say, you know, about 2,800 homes are demolished every year in Metro Vancouver, and about 540 of them are in really good condition and could easily be moved to a new location. So you're saving on, you know, you're not creating that much waste. You're saving on the demolition costs and the carbon emissions from that. And on top of that, you're preventing a really expensive new build somewhere else. You know, if there's a lot in Powell River that needs a new home, the cost of moving that home from Burnaby to there is actually, I think it's about a third of the cost of building a new home in Powell River.
And the city has a huge role in facilitating this, because of course, you know, moving a home, an object that large, really requires the city's cooperation, because things have to be done on roads and sometimes power lines have to be taken down and put back up. So the city has a huge role in actually making this easier and, as you say, minimizing the delays that cost money for the developer.
Yeah, and it seems like councillors were pretty receptive to this at the last council meeting. The mayor said it was something that we should just kind of get going on to see how we can make this easier for companies like this. And we did hear a motion come forward from Councillor Daniel Tetreault to direct staff to see basically how the city could work with companies like this and to make it easier for developers to feel that this is the right choice for them. And that was carried unanimously. So I think we'll see some updates on that in the next months and years.
That sounds like a great initiative. Burnaby is also looking at developing its own district energy utility. So setting up a way to generate its own utility from waste. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so it's the Burnaby District Energy Utility would be like a city-run kind of energy corporation, I guess, to provide power and heat to they're starting with homes in Metrotown and Edmonds, because those are the two neighborhoods where Burnaby is expecting to see almost half of all population growth in the next two decades. And the way this would work is it's planning on taking energy from an existing facility that already is operating in Burnaby. It's run by Metro Vancouver. It's called the Waste to Energy Facility, and it's basically an incinerator. But instead of just burning waste and letting it float off into the stratosphere, it takes that waste and that energy, and it converts it into electricity and heat that can be used to power, like I said, homes and businesses in terms of heating and hot water.
Well, that sounds really interesting, but it doesn't come without criticism.
That's right. So we've reported on this facility actually a couple of times in the past couple of years. There are some organizations that have their eye on, you know, climate change and how do we reduce emissions that say that it's going in the wrong direction because it's still focusing on the existence of waste. You know, on one hand, we're saying we need to reduce the amount of waste in general. And on the other hand, we're looking at powering our homes through these facilities that rely on waste. Mm-hmm. So organizations like Zero Waste BC say that the wrong way to go. They're pointing to examples in places like Hawaii, where they use a similar system there, and they actually cut back on recycling programs because they said that they needed the garbage. So, you know, it's kind of a two sides of the same coin here, but there's definitely disagreements on whether using a facility like this is the right way forward.
Where would they be? They'd just be getting local waste then?
They actually get waste from quite a few communities around the region. Burnaby, the North Shore, I want to say Richmond, but maybe I'm misremembering. And again, I've got a figure in my head that I'm not remembering, but it's a lot of waste that they work with that they turn into heat. And they're already... They've already got a deal in place to set this kind of system up in the River District in Vancouver. And if they go forward with this, which it seems like they're pretty close to doing, the city expects that it's going to start powering homes and businesses in Metrotown and Edmonds by 2026.
Right. So does this facility, is it very large? Does it take up a lot of room? I guess I'm wondering because, of course, you know, last week we were talking about how the green recycling and organics facility for Fraser Foreshore Park is being paused and not going to go there, and they're looking for another site. Is mm-hmm. this kind of facility even comparable to that, or is it something quite different, like size-wise?
It is quite a large facility. I don't know that I have the like number of acres it takes up on hand or anything like that, but it is actually kind of in the same neighborhood as the grow facility would have been located. It's in that Big Bend area right by the river.
Yeah.
Which is an industrial area, I would call it, in and of itself.
Yeah. All right. Well, great. That's what's happening in Burnaby this week. Thank you, Srishti.
Thanks so much for having me. We'll talk again next week.
Yeah, Srishti Gangdev, a reporter with the Burnaby Beacon. How do people find more about the Beacon?
Yeah, just head to our website, burnabybeacon.com, and you can put your name, your email address, I should say, in the little box that pops up there, and you'll get a handy newsletter every single weekday morning with local politics, local news, events, restaurants, everything you need to know in Burnaby that day.
Great. Thanks for being here this week. We'll be back next week with more What's Up in Burnaby. Thanks, Srishti.
All right. Bye-bye.
And now for some weather for the Vancouver area. Next couple of days, well, today and tomorrow are looking pretty decent. Not as nice as Saturday, mind you, but probably nicer than yesterday. Looks like we're going to have some clouds and a mix of sun and cloud through the afternoon. 30% chance of showers and some wet flurries. Always exciting to get a little April snow. Fog patches developing overnight, a low down to 2. Tomorrow is going to be mainly cloudy with a 30% chance of showers or wet flurries in the morning, then clearing late in the morning with some fog patches that will dissipate. High up to 10, low down to 0 overnight. And then the rest of the week is sort of cloudy and showers and cloudy and showers, and it's going to be like that all the way through to Sunday. All right, bit of music here for you. This is Lana Del Rey, and this is a special request from my daughter. It's her birthday today. Happy birthday, Beatrix. And here is Lana Del Rey and Paris, Texas. Lana Del Rey from her recently released album, Did You Know There's a Tunnel Under Ocean Boulevard? That was Paris, Texas, featuring SYML. All right. We have next up is our interview with SFU 350. They're a student group here at SFU working towards mitigating climate change, and they have some campaigns that they're working on. I had a chance to talk to them yesterday over Zoom, with one coming to me us from Vancouver and the other in Japan. And here is my interview. Joining me today are Jaden Dyer and Natasha Eveco from SFU 350. They're Simon Fraser University student organization. So you guys... maybe before we get started, you guys can just tell me a little bit about your roles with SFU 350, and then we'll talk about what SFU 350 is doing. Start with you, Jaden.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, everyone. I'm Jaden. I'm an executive member with SFU 350, and specifically a member of their Divestment and Community Reinvestment Working Group. This is a committee that it's a part of SFU 350 that work to pressure the university to fully divest from fossil fuels back in 2021 and has now been transitioning into the community reinvestment side, which has been pressuring the university to move 10% of their endowment into impact investment initiatives, essentially. Yeah, I'll pass it over to you, Natasha.
Yeah, thanks. So my name is Natasha, and my role at 350 is, I have a couple things that I do, but I am the community core lead, which involves intaking new members and doing member retention and things like that. And I'm also a member of the Community Reinvestment Working Group. And yeah, like Jaden was saying, that's essentially what we work on. And I'm not an executive member of this group, but I would say that I'm highly involved.
Excellent. So tell me a bit about what is SAP 350 and what does it do?
Yeah, so we are a student-led club at SFU that works to engage the SFU community both on and off campus in tackling climate change issues. And so we have different committees that focus on different aspects of the climate crisis. So no matter what your interest or your passion is related to climate justice, you'll be able to find it here in this club. Our specific working group that we were talking about on divestment and community reinvestment is looking at sort of the financial side of the climate crisis. How is it being funded? And what can we do to change that, essentially? How are we going to transition from funding the fossil fuel industry to funding community reinvestment initiatives? And community reinvestment is projects that are happening locally here in the community to build a more sustainable community. A lot of these are indigenous led as well. They can be projects such as developing like solar panels to help to basically run the energy circuit of an entire community. So projects like that are how we're going to see our future sort of moving forward. And so, yeah, that's what I'm personally really passionate about. And that's why I was so excited to get to join a committee that is focused specifically on that, on about how we're going to like fund our future, especially because we are that future as students. Like, where do we want to see this go? It sort of needs to start now while we're still in university.
Right. So why is it important to tackle this financial side of this activism rather than, say, more hands-on stuff? Natasha?
I would say that because a lot of the impact that we're seeing in the world with fossil fuel emissions, a lot of this is funded by banks, and in particular in Canada, there are five big banks. I believe that they're TD, RBC, CIBC, BMO, and I'm missing one. Jaden, do you remember?
Scotiabank,
right. Yes, of course. Yeah, and these banks in particular invest a lot of their money into fossil fuel projects across Canada and in the world. And that's why we believe, and for this particular campaign that we were doing, we were also collaborating with Banking on a Better Future, which is a Canada-wide organization that focuses on getting banks to divest from fossil fuel projects. And yeah, that's why we believe that the financial side of things is so important, because our money is being directly invested into these very unethical projects.
So, did you want to say something?
Just that. Yeah, it's a very personal situation. I think that it's easy to sort of, to feel very disconnected from the financial end, and then feel like you don't personally have any influence on it. But it is our money that is being indirectly invested here, especially because, yeah, as students, we are funding the SFSS, and then the SFSS is going on to, to then end up loaning that money into the fossil fuel sector just by having accounts with Scotiabank, but also your own personal accounts too. Like I, for example, I used to bank with TD, which does loan to fossil fuel projects. But